Shocking nurse safety, older moms and younger children, antidepressants and miscarriage. Plus, we'll take a look at drowning injuries. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a lot of good information coming up for you here, and if you're a brand new listener here to The Nursing Show, you'll want to make sure you head over to nursingshow.com and check out all of the additional resources available for you over there, including the brand new video versions of the show. So if you'd like to watch The Nursing Show as kind of a half hour show, TV show on the web, you can do that. I'm recording all of the episodes from here on out, at least as many as I can, on a studio version, and you'll be able to see me produce the podcast and in a live setting, kind of recording live while I record the show. You can find all of that over at nursingshow.com. And also, of course, the links to all of the information discussed in every episode in the show notes category. And you'll find the show notes link right there at the top of the page. Just click on that link, find the episode you're looking for, and then go ahead and follow up on additional news stories and additional things you'll find there related to each week's tip of the week. It's my way to make sure that you have the resources you need to take the little bits of information I provide here and figure out how they apply to your own specific instructional guidelines, scope of practice, Nurse Practice Act, whatever the case may be. So make sure you follow up on that information. You'll also be able to sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter there, and you can get all those links sent directly to your email address whenever a new episode is posted. And again, that's all available over at nursingshow.com. If you want to get in touch with me directly, I love to hear from the Nursing Show listeners. Shoot me an email. Send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. You can also get a hold of me by just leaving a comment on any of the articles over at the Nursing Show site. Whenever you leave a comment there, it sends me an email. So you can get in touch with me that way, and I will usually just leave a comment right back to your comment on the site. It's a great way to foster communication between the listeners on the show. Also, if you want, you can always touch base with me over at Facebook. Facebook.com/podmedic is my link there. And I've had a lot of listeners touch base with me recently over at the Facebook site. In fact, I'm planning during a upcoming family vacation in just a couple of weeks, here at the end of June, beginning of July, I'm going to be down in the Orlando, Florida area. Now, it's a family vacation, but whenever I go on these trips, I always try to square away a couple of hours to meet with listeners. So if you're in the Orlando area or close enough that you might be interested in driving in, we're looking maybe Tuesday or Wednesday evening, getting together sometime around dinner time, maybe catching up for a bite to eat, sitting down. I love to meet Nursing Show listeners. So if you're interested in doing that, definitely send me an email or contact me over at Facebook and let me know that you're interested. And then I'll get back in touch with you with the details. I'm working with one of my listeners down there to find a location nearby. And we're looking maybe at like a Panera Bread kind of thing. So if you're interested in going and meeting up and maybe getting a bite to eat and sitting around, we can do that for an hour or so. And I'd love to get an opportunity to meet with you. So that's coming up again here at the end of the month, beginning of July. So if you're interested, definitely follow up with me. I did hear from one listener, and let me check in on that email here. I'll bring it up on my screen. Heard from listener Sonia. Now, we talk a lot about things going on here in the United States, and other parts of the world are included in the Nursing Show audience. Sonia actually watches the show and is working on her nursing studies in Bosnia, and was asking questions about where she can get good online resources for education. Is there a way that she can become a registered nurse and get her nursing degree in the United States online as a distance learner? And I didn't have a lot of information for her. I did respond back to her email, because I do respond back to all your emails. But I did want to maybe throw this out here to the Nursing Show community. You know, I don't have all the answers, but the best thing about this show is that this is a community effort. So do you have any ideas or information about online distance learning opportunities or transferring in other degree educational opportunities from another country to the United States. If you could shoot me that information, send it into nursingshow@gmail.com and maybe include some information. Maybe I can follow up with you and maybe even do a short interview segment, because I'm sure Sonia is not the only person with questions about this type of thing. And so I urge you to follow up and get back in touch with me. And Sonia, thank you very much for shooting in that email. And I will try to get an answer for you better than the shorter answer I sent back to you with some additional resources there. Again, if you'd like to get back in touch with me, nursingshow@gmail.com, or leave a comment over at nursingshow.com. Time now to jump into this week's news items, and I'm going to start off with a story that's shocking, and that actually means shocking. This is a story I picked up out of medicalnewstoday.com, and it is a story from a June issue of Anesthesia and Analgesia magazine, and it's the Journal of the International Anesthesia Research Society. Apparently, a nurse sustained an electrical injury during an operation, and this was a problem. They want to look at changing the electrical codes that are used in operating room equipment because of the injuries, because they are wet environments, and, you know, obviously, when we have a body open to a surgical procedure, there are fluids available, and not just water, but fluids that are really good at conducting electricity because of the salts dissolved in there. So we need to have safer procedures for nurses and other members of the teams operating on patients. This particular situation occurred during a routine operation. The nurse was asked to plug in a piece of equipment, and there was water spilled on the floor in the OR that had been used for the irrigation equipment in this particular procedure. She was kneeling on the floor, had the hand on the plug, and ended up giving herself quite a shock when plugging in the operating room, plugging in the piece of equipment during this procedure. It caused her to be knocked backward and suffered a ruptured eardrum and missed 2 weeks of work as a result of this injury. So not a minor injury, not just a little jolt or a little tingle, but certainly a significant injury. And there needs to be some safety changes to this as we use more and more electrical equipment. You know, once upon a time in an operating theater, a lot of the equipment was hand-operated and was manual use equipment. But more and more often, we are using more and more high-tech equipment, and high-tech equipment needs electricity. So certainly this is something that is increasing the safety of all members of the healthcare team in an operating room setting. But I think that there is some definite need to change the way that the electrical equipment is put in place in operating rooms, and the electrical code should be adjusted appropriately. You can find more links on this in the links in the show notes. And again, that's from Anesthesia and Analgesia Journal from the June issue, if you want to look that up for yourself. Next up in the news, an article from the UK. And this is a look at 2009 figures for England and Wales. And this was reported recently by the Office of National Statistics for England, looking at the fact that the average age of women giving birth has increased, and that there are a much larger number of older women that are having younger babies, obviously. So their children are younger, and they're starting later in life to begin having children. This is something that is unusual, and especially for first-time mothers. So they're looking at a lot of different statistics. The rates for younger women dropped. So women under the age of 25 actually dropped during the period 2008 and 2009. And they also dropped for some of the other younger age groups. However, the average age increased for women over the age of 40 by almost 3%. So there is a concern that, of course, if an older woman is having a child, there may be additional complications. There may be increased need for prenatal care beyond normal prenatal care. And of course, if you have prenatal care, you're going to be getting those additional services. But this is important information to keep in mind. And I have a feeling, I haven't seen statistics on the U.S. on this, but I wouldn't be surprised to find that these numbers are increasing in a lot of developed nations. As more and more women are engaged in their careers, as that change has taken place over the past decades, that change has encouraged women to be more career-focused earlier in life and more family-focused as their careers have become established. They then can fall back and look at developing their family relationships. And so that's something that we should keep in mind, and we should be aware of asking those kinds of questions. We might think that some women are past childbearing age, but we're seeing more and more frequently women later in life having babies. And of course, I'm a guy. I have little experience to talk about this, but I urge you to get back with me and give me your response. I know we have quite a few labor and delivery and OB nurses out there. Give me your impressions on what you think about this particular topic. Anecdotally, even, have you seen that the age of your patients is increasing, and that are there any particular issues in nursing care that you have to adjust to deal with this particular change in our patient? So just interested to hear back from you. Again, nursingshow@gmail.com, or leave a comment on the website. I'd love to hear back a response from some of you on this topic. Finally, as we talk about childbirth, we also find that there may be a link between some antidepressant medications and miscarriage. Now, we know that there are medications that are not recommended or contraindicated in patients who are pregnant, but in cases where pregnancy is very early on, and perhaps in cases where the patient doesn't even know that they're pregnant, this can cause a problem for patients that are taking medications on a regular basis. So we need to educate our patients about all medications they take. And if we have a patient who is of childbearing age, we should advise them on the fact that if they are interested in having children and starting to have children, they should consult with their physician or with their nurse and find out about the medications they're taking, and are they going to be safe if they become pregnant before the pregnancy is discovered. So we need to find out about that. I did find this article over at health.usnews.com, so you can follow up on that particular article. I'm just finding out the resources. This is actually a Canadian study that looked at 5,000 women and that found that certain antidepressants, such as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, caused the pregnancy to have an increased risk of miscarriage. And certainly, when someone has depression issues, we need to find ways to manage that. But we may have to switch them to other medications, or we may have to talk with those patients and find ways to refer them to perhaps additional behavioral therapies during the pregnancy and nursing period afterwards until they're able to safely resume their medications. And so these are things that we need to be prepared for when patients have a history of depression. So be careful. Make sure you're asking that question of your patients. If you are in the labor and delivery maternity care arena, you certainly want to make sure that you are asking questions about history and including their psych history, because we need to know if there's other opportunities or options that can be opened up for these patients if they can no longer take their antidepressants. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to jump in and talk a little bit about the issues surrounding patients who have submersion injuries, drowning or near drowning situations, and about a little bit about water safety, because it's summertime here in the U.S. in my region, and water safety is one of my hot button issues, as we have a lot of patients opening up their summer pools, going and participating in waterborne activities. So let's jump on in and talk a little bit about this particular issue. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things we're going to be covering in this particular segment. We'll be talking about statistics on drowning in the United States. Also, the physiology associated with drowning. What happens when someone drowns or has a long-term submersion? How does the injury happen? What kind of things happen to the body during that case? We'll also talk about treating and reviving that drowning patient and prevention and safety issues, both for the patient and for ourselves if we're in a situation where we may be a rescuer or potential rescuer. Finally, of course, nursing considerations to consider when caring for a patient who has suffered a near-drowning injury or comes into an emergency department after a submersion, prolonged submersion, some of the things we want to keep in mind when treating those patients. So what about drownings in the U.S.? In the United States, this accounts for more than 3,500 deaths. And the most recent statistics I was able to easily find over at the Centers for Disease Control site were from 2006. Certainly, I have a feeling those numbers have increased since then, but at that time, there were over 3,500 deaths occurring in the United States as a result of drowning. 25% of those drowning deaths were people under the age of 14, and this is the second leading cause of accidental death in these age groups. So we need to keep this in mind that this is a child safety issue, and we'll look a little bit later on here at the numbers for even younger children are really severe when related to certain things. There are 8.8 million residential pools in the United States, and there are safety concerns associated with those pools. What are we doing in our communities to look at pool safety? Obviously, there are many places that have safety codes regarding fences and locking gates, but are those gates actually in good working order? Are older pools grandfathered in and do not require any kind of fencing around them? These are big safety issues. You know, a kid sees a swimming pool and they don't think about whether it's their neighbor's or not. They just go and get in the pool. If they can't swim, that's something they don't think about until they're already in the water. So we need to be very careful and very proactive in preventing injuries. 70% of the drownings in swimming pools are in children aged 1 to 4, young toddlers and young preschool-aged children who are able to get around, are becoming more and more independent, and are able to open and go through doors on their own. These children, when you have a pool, need increased scrutiny. Doors, latches, gates need to be maintained and locked in these situations, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on, but prevention really is the key in drowning injuries. In boating accidents on open water, lakes, rivers, the ocean, these types of injuries, 80% of the drownings that occur in boating injuries occur in patients that did not have a life jacket on when they went in the water, or there was not one on board for them when the boat had an accident. So this is from the U.S. Coast Guard information, and this, again, a water safety prevention issue. Do we have life vests available? Are we fitting patients with life vests? It doesn't matter if you can swim really well. If your boat has a sudden incident happen where it's capsized or it strikes an object and goes under suddenly, you could be knocked unconscious. Your life vests are designed to try to keep you afloat in such a way that you will float upright and your airway will hopefully remain open. It's not all the time, but your life vest will keep you afloat better than not having one on. And in these situations, 80% of the drownings on boat-related accidents are related to people who did not wear life vests. So let's talk about some of the things about the physiology of drowning. We hear drowning or near drowning. What does that mean? Well, drowning and near drowning refer to the time frame related to a fatality. So drowning, in its simplest definition, death from asphyxia within 24 hours of a submersion incident. So if someone has gone in the water, become submerged, stopped breathing, or was blocked from having access to oxygen for a period of time after that submersion, and they die within 24 hours, it's considered a drowning. Okay? someone has a submerging injury and they live 24 hours in 1 minute and then they die, it's considered a near drowning death. And this is just how they report these things in the morbidity and mortality reports. But it's something to keep in mind. When you hear these terms, what do they mean? Drowning or near drowning? Drowning refers to a person who dies within that first 24 hours. Near drowning could be anyone who lives beyond the 24-hour mark, even if it's only for a short period of time. Near drowning, submersion can result in death for either of these things, but there are two different ways that people will die, and it's resulting from asphyxia. But what's causing the asphyxia? What's causing the blockage of oxygen exchange in the lungs? There are two different things: wet drowning and dry drowning. Wet drowning refers to aspiration of the water, the fluid in which the patient is drowning. That fluid is aspirated into the lungs, and that fluid itself fills up the airway spaces, and there's nowhere for gas exchange to occur. That's aspiration, that's wet drowning. Dry drowning occurs when water first strikes the larynx. The laryngospasm that occurs actually closes off the airway, and that laryngospasm keeps any fluids from going down into the lungs for an extended period of time, and the patient is still underwater. That fluid is still present, and the laryngospasm is built to keep that fluid out of the lungs. They can't take a breath because they're underwater anyway, but they have a dry drowning. There is no aspiration of fluid into the lungs, but the laryngospasm, by being submerged and that fluid constantly being in trying to get into the airway, causes the patient to have a dry drowning, to asphyxiate without any fluid actually getting into the lungs. So wet drowning versus dry drowning. One of the most significant problems with drowning injuries is that patients, when we try to revive them, have a host of problems physiologically that will occur if we do revive them. There are things that happen during asphyxia. There are things that happen during this period of time where they are in either respiratory or cardiac arrest, and those problems come back to haunt the patient when we begin to revive them. This includes cerebral edema, acidosis, the pulmonary effects of aspiration drowning. If they do have a wet drowning, what was the water in which they drowned? Was it a freshwater source? Was it a saltwater source? How clean was that water? All of these things can bring all kinds of problems. Freshwater will disrupt the surfactant on the alveoli, causing the alveoli to collapse. That surfactant will not be there to keep them open. The freshwater washes and disrupts that surfactant effect. Salt water comes into the lungs, and because of it's a hypertonic solution, it starts drawing fluids from osmotic pressure out of the vascular pathways and causes significant pulmonary edema after the fact. So as we revive these patients, we have to deal with not only perhaps the salt water in their lungs, but the additional body fluid that's invading the lungs, the space in the alveoli, because of the salt water presence. So we have increased pulmonary edema caused by that. We also have ingestion related. Somebody has a dry drowning, but a ton of water gets down into their GI tract. That flood of water into their GI tract and absorption into the body disrupts the electrolyte balances in the body, causing arrhythmias and other issues. So we need to be aware of all these types of physiological problems. And then after the fact, a day, 2 days later, we have significant risk for infection, and not just pneumonia, which we might think of first because of the aspiration issues, but also other types of infections. There's all kinds of things living in water, and giving them an opportunity to have prolonged access to the body's tissues, we see increased incidence of all kinds of broad spectrum infections, including central nervous system infections and septicemia. So certainly infection becomes a later problem with patients after they've been revived, and increased vigilance is necessary. So what are we looking at for treatment? If you have a patient who's had a submersion injury, treatments initially are pretty standardized and basic, and you learn them all in your basic CPR courses. We need airway management, we need application of our CPR skills and guidelines, And in most cases, we need some form of warming of the patient. Most, even in the summertime and in warm areas, the water temperature is still much cooler than body temperature. And so patients go into water that's even 70 degrees. That patient cools down their core body temperature. So again, it comes back to that age-old adage, a patient is not dead until they are warm and dead, because that chilling can actually help sustain them, and we may be able to rewarm them during the resuscitation process, and this may be done through gastric lavage or other techniques. So we need to be aware that there are other things we might be needing to do to rewarm these patients. Be wary of traumatic injuries that occur. Again, why did the patient go in the water? This goes back to my age-old push for good history-taking techniques. We need to understand the circumstances that led up to the problem at hand. And in a drowning situation, that's especially important. If a patient was a good swimmer but suffered a drowning injury, why did that happen? Well, if they dove into murky water and struck an underwater object with their head, they may have suffered a C-spine injury. So the head, neck, spine injury problems that can occur lead to increased vigilance on our part. We need to assess patients carefully. We need to maintain C-spine stabilization in these patients until we've ruled out traumatic injury, because, you know, it would be an awful shame to revive this patient only to find out that in the course of reviving them, we disregarded the fact that they may have had a traumatic injury and caused a paralyzation to occur in the process of reviving them. Now, certainly life before limb, but again, keep these things in the back of your mind. If we can maintain C-spine stabilization during the resuscitation process, it makes everything work out a lot better at the other end if we do revive the patient. We need to treat hypoxemia with O2 and proper ventilation technique. We need to manage those ventilations. We may need to increase the PEEP pressure to help force fluids out of the lungs into the vascular space if we have a saltwater drowning and we're having that increased pulmonary edema. Deep suctioning techniques may be necessary to suction out the airways that we're able to reach. We need to treat those side effects. Remember, I talked about the physiological effects of a submersion injury in these patients. We need to be able to treat those side effects. We need to be prepared for the fact that that rush of acidosis that's going to occur when we cause a return of circulation is going to cause a broad spectrum of inflammatory effects, including an increase in cerebral edema. We need to be prepared for the infection that's going to likely crop up soon after we revive these patients, within a day or so. And so we've revived them only to have them go into complete septic shock. We need to probably are going to be prophylactically treating these patients with some broad spectrum antibiotics and doing multiple cultures during the course of treatment after the fact. Pulmonary edema is certainly something to keep in mind after they've been resuscitated, even in freshwater injuries. And swimming pools could be considered freshwater, but remember, depending on the pool chemicals that are added, the pool chemicals may be causing them to be hypertonic as well. So we need to look at pool injuries. Pool drownings may be either considered freshwater or saltwater, and it'll depend on the types of pool chemicals that they use and whether they recently had to increase the amount of chemical in their pool for an event that occurred in order to shock the pool system. So they may have more than normal amounts of chemical available, and that could also change the outcome. Of course, outcomes aren't very good for submersion injuries. So what's the most important thing? Prevention and water safety are key. And I come back to this again and again. It's one of the reasons I hit this topic almost every single year, because I think the most important thing to keep in mind about drowning and submersion injuries is that we can stop them and prevent them. Almost all of them are completely preventable. People who swim alone shouldn't. Young children should be monitored at all times. Pools should have gates on them, latches, fences in good working order. They should, if a pool has a fence around the yard and that's considered okay by your standards, the door of the house to the backyard need to be maintained and locked so that young children cannot get outside. And so that's something to keep in mind. There's lots of information. I also want to start off here with rescuer safety. Rescuer safety is paramount. If someone is drowning, if someone is in the water and calling for help, should you jump in and just go rescue them? Unless you've been trained to do so, the answer is no, because then we have two people in the water. That person, if they're panicking, are likely to use you as a way to climb higher out of the water. And what happens is they just push you under. Now we have two people with submersion injuries. So you need to be very careful. You need to use proper safety training. If you're a lifeguard or you've been trained in swift water or water rescue, great, go for it. Otherwise, stay safely on land and reach that person with some object, either a long branch, a ladder, a rope, some other object. If you are on a boat, use a safety flotation device and throw it to them. You want to make sure that you are protected first, because otherwise we end up with two patients, and that's not a good thing. The poor resuscitation profile, so we want to make sure we're really focusing on safety and prevention issues. Community prevention programs are great. You know, if you don't have a pool safety program in your facility or your office, whether you are in a pediatrician's office, in a primary care office, in a hospital setting, if you're a home care nurse, whatever the case may be, summertime's a great time to just make a quick handout. And guess what? The CDC provides these for free. You can actually download them and print them out. They're great. You can go ahead and be a person who provides that additional, hey, wake-up call for your patients and your community by sponsoring pool safety things. If you're a home care nurse, it's easy and takes only a few minutes to offer a free pool safety inspection to your patients. It takes very little time. You're in the home anyway. You're already doing home safety inspections for these patients, looking for loose rugs and cords and things like that. You know, offer to go back and look at their backyard. Make up a checklist that's easy to use. Go back and check for the operation of the gate. Does it close on its own? Does it latch securely when it closes? Those kinds of things. And then go back and tell the patient about it. It's just, again, awareness is half the battle in these situations. So through those safety inspections, promote swim lessons in your community. You know, if I can do nothing else, I would just say people need to know how to swim, both adults and children. And in some cases, you know, children love to go in the water and want to learn how to swim, and they would love it. Swim lessons for kids often involve games and a lot of fun, and they to be for all age groups from babies on up to encourage them to learn how to help themselves. But what about adults? Adults are often embarrassed by these situations. Work with your local pools. Maybe offer an adult education swim class that occurs after normal pool hours in the evenings when no one else is around watching them, when they aren't in this pool with the little kids trying to do the same things little kids are learning. So there's no embarrassment involved. And then these adults can learn to swim too. So make these initiatives available in your community. Basic nursing considerations to keep in mind: you should always maintain your basic life support skills. The thing that's going to make the biggest impact initially with any recently rescued person from a submersion or drowning injury is going to be basic CPR skills. Opening the airway, giving breaths, and chest compressions. Doing those things well, adequately, good, strong, deep, fast chest compressions, and good airway management are going to be key in these patients, and those are your basic BLS skills. You want to get the history of the event. Again, remember, those traumatic injuries and things could have occurred. We need to understand what happened. Was it a freshwater or saltwater drowning? Did it happen in a pool or not? Who else was around? What occurred? Assess for side effects of resuscitation continuously. We talked about these things, but you really want to be watching for all of the things, the cascade of events that'll happen once we resuscitate these patients that are going to occur in the hours and days following the event. We need to be very vigilant. And as nurses, we're on the front lines of watching those things and watching and making sure that they, if they do occur, that we're ahead of the game and not being caught by surprise. Monitor your patients for signs of infection and also for neurological assessment. There are significant chances of a brain injury occurring in these patients because of the prolonged asphyxia. We do resuscitate them, but there may be brain damage. Good neurologic assessment skills are going to be very important in these situations, and you should be up to date on how to assess for neuro injury and for what level of damage they have. And I'm not just talking about spinal cord injury assessment, but assessing for basic cognitive function and all that go along with a total neurologic assessment. Depending on what's going on with your patient, we want to see what function comes back, and then we may see a return of increased function over time during the recovery process. And the best way to do that is to have good, thorough assessment going on regularly, and the nurses are going to be part of that process. There are great resources available for you on education, on water safety, and prevention available from the links I'm providing in the additional resources. So you'll want to follow up on those resources, and they'll be available in the show notes on this video segment. You'll definitely want to follow up on those resources and use them. And again, there are downloads available for free from the CDC and other sites out there that are easy to print out and post up in your community, hand out to your patients, and make available to other healthcare professionals so that they know that they're out there and where they can get them. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you that look back in The Nursing Show in the show notes for this episode to find all of the links for the news items and the tip of the week segment for this week. You will find lots of additional links and resources, and I really try to provide those things for you because I can only give you brief overviews here on the show, and I may misspeak or make a mistake. You need to follow up, and you need to understand how that applies to your scope of practice and then apply that information appropriately. And, you know, 15-minute segment here on The Nursing Show is great for review, but I will provide you hours of additional reading and resources if you need them here at The Nursing Show site. And again, that's nursingshow.com, and you'll click on the show notes link at the top of the page. You'll find the most recent episode listed first, but you can scroll down and go back in time to find any episode of The Nursing Show if you're looking for specific resources from that week's show. Again, always want to remind you, we're now doing more video segments here at The Nursing Show, so if you're watching the video episode, you can also sign up to get the audio version of the show downloaded directly and for free over at iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, and you'll find those links in the upper right-hand side of the page for The Nursing Show audio program. And we'll be including links to get the free video version if you want to download the video of the show and take it with you or make it available so you can watch it on your computer anytime you want. That'll be available as well, and you'll find that showing up on the nursingshow.com website in just the next few weeks or so. If you want to get back in touch with me, have any comments you'd like to make, I love to hear from you. Please get in touch with me. You can send those emails into nursingshow@gmail.com. You can also always reach me, leave a link over at the website on any of the articles or on the show notes for this episode. There's a comments link at the top and the bottom of the page. You can also go over and get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. But I want to make a big push here at The Nursing Show. I want to get more fans over at the Nursing Show fan page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/nursingshow. And, you know, we've been looking for ways to increase the people over there and find more fans. It's a great way to talk back and forth and communicate with folks. So I want to encourage you, if you could, if you're already a fan of the Nursing Show page over at Facebook, great. If you could share some of the information that you find over there, check in there on a regular basis and share it back to your pages or recommend it to some of your friends, that would be a real big help. And I'm looking for ways to increase the numbers over there. My Medicast page has over 1,600 fans, and for some reason, Nursing Show has a lot of listeners, but for some reason, we're not getting as many fans over at the Nursing Show page. So I thought I'd open that up to you, the listeners. If you're listening to the show and you have a Facebook page and you haven't checked out facebook.com/nursingshow, go over there, become a fan, like the page, and then you'll be able to get some of the special updates and information I post over there as well. And I've just been looking for a little support if you could share that. Also, again, if you're in the Orlando area, within however close you want to drive to it, I'm going to be looking forward to seeing you right the last week of June, beginning of July. Sometime that week, we're going to be down there. My family is on vacation, but I'm going to be taking some time out for you, the listeners and viewers here of The Nursing Show. So if you're interested and want to come by and visit, send me an email or contact me over on Facebook, and I will add you to the list, and I'll contact you and give you the details. I'm going to be ironing that out over the next week or so, and I look forward to meeting you. We're just going to kind of get together someplace where we can get a quick bite to eat and sit and chat and get a chance to meet, and I'm looking forward to that opportunity. So definitely catch up with me over there, down there in Orlando when we're down there in a couple of weeks. That's it for me. Let me close out the show here at The Nursing Show with some great PodSafe music. It's summertime, so I thought I would bring up the song by Brother Love called Summertime. If you haven't checked out his music, you'll find a link in the show notes to find his songs, both directly at his website, or you can go over and use the button there and check out his music over at iTunes. And if you like it, go ahead and purchase one or two of his songs. It's a great way to show your support for these artists, and it's a great way to continue having them provide great music here to shows like The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again next week, every Friday morning, with a new episode here of The Nursing Show. You'll find that at nursingshow.com. And in the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Yeah, too.